Okay, thanks for the organizers of the program and also of the conference for giving me the opportunity to talk here. I would like to talk about adiabatic quantum computing with parity constraints. The work was done with Peter, of course, then Philipp Hauke, Alex Gästle, Rick von Beinen, Martin Leib, and Markus Heil and Lars Bonnes. If you think about quantum computing in general, then what we mean with this is that we would like to use the properties of quantum mechanics like entanglement, superposition, and measurement as a resource for computing. And there are basically two main branches in this field. One is the universal quantum computer, and one will be quantum simulation. So they are kind of distinct in what we want to do with them. In the universal quantum computer, we are thinking mainly about gate models or one-way computing, where by a sequence of gates, we would like to generate some state. In quantum simulation, the strategy is a bit different there. What we want to do is we want to mimic a quantum system with another one which we can actually control. And a relative recent proposal on adiabatic quantum computing is somehow in between. It actually shares many similarities from both sides. On the one hand, it is universal, so one can actually simulate any gate model in an adiabatic fashion. On the other hand, one actually requires really to build the Hamiltonian that one wants to use in the computation. And let me, on the next few slides, give you a little bit an intuition what these lines actually mean. The general idea of adiabatic quantum computing was probably put forward by Hidetoshi, Nishimori, and Ed Fari. The idea is to have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which consists of two terms. One term would be a trivial one, and one would be the problem Hamiltonian. And now what we want to do is we want to switch our Hamiltonian from the trivial one to the problem Hamiltonian. So here T is the time, and capital T is the total time, which means at the beginning we only have the trivial one, and in the end we only have the problem Hamiltonian. Now, the protocol would look like this. We would prepare our system in the initial, in the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian, so this is something that we can trivially do. And then we evolve the system in time, and at the same time change the Hamiltonian to the problem Hamiltonian. Now, if you look at this example, where our trivial Hamiltonian would be, for example, just sigma x, sum of sigma x, and our problem Hamiltonian would be something, a complicated spin glass, for example. So this this JRJ matrix could be a fully connected spin glass. Then if we evolve the system, because they do not commute, we actually get only avoided crossings, and this means if we start in the ground state here, then we have a high chance to end up in the ground state of our problem Hamiltonian.
And
sorry?
You should have time
ordering
also.
Yes. right, yes. Thank you. Now, what's actually the requirement for adiabaticity here? So, in the end, it's like a Landau-Sina problem, no? But a many-body version of it. And the naive way of looking at this problem would be that we only have to look at the minimal gap. So this means if we have like the Landau-Sena Hamiltonian, then we actually know the time scale which makes the system adiabatic. So if we have a single particle with sigma x and sigma c, and we have a delta splitting here, then the time scale at which we can do this adiabatically is simply given by delta squared over the velocity at which we change our Hamiltonian. So if we parameterize our Hamiltonian with the x-axis, let's call this s here, Then the time scale at which we can switch our Hamiltonian, such that we are still in the ground state in the end, must be much larger than delta squared over the velocity at which we change this Hamiltonian. Now, of course, if we have now many body system, then this gap goes down exponentially. So this means we have some exponential slowdown at which speed we can actually do this. However, what exactly happens at this minimal gap for a many body system is actually quite a complicated story. So we can get into MBL phase, we can have many of these transitions. So this is one of the main challenges in the field to actually understand what's going on here in the many body case for general problems. Now, another question is on coherence. So what happens if you actually have an open system here? And there was a very nice recent paper on this by the Looking group with Noam Yao and Michael Knapp and co-workers, which just appeared in PRL, where they actually showed that you have to do this coherently. So you have to stay at zero temperature to make this scalable. What they looked at was the Grover problem. And if you want to do this for larger and larger systems, if you have any temperature or dissipative processes, then you cannot make this scalable in any way. So this means this rules actually out some computation where we can have a large system and couple it to a buff, at least without error correction. Now, another aspect about this is the universality. Now, if we we can actually simulate any gate model with adiabatic quantum computing. However, the overhead, if we want to do this, is quite large. So this means doing universal quantum computing might not be the best application of this problem. And actually, we would like to rather do like a search algorithm, for example, like the Grover algorithm, or optimization problems. So one can actually show that the Grover algorithm, for example, can be implemented optimally, which means that for small systems, we expect the quadratic speedup, which is the maximum that we can expect from adiabatic quantum computing. Now, which resource do we actually use, or which quantum resource do we use? It's actually entanglement. And I think it's very illustrative to look at entanglement in such a sweep. Let's take again the example where we start in the trivial sigma x state, and we end up in a spin glass state. So imagine here, this is sort of the trivial part which we have on in the beginning, and this is the hard part which we have on in the end. And this problem part now consists of an infinite range spin glass. Then again, this will be the spectrum here. The ground state is now actually the zero line, and we have here somewhere a minimal gap. And now if we look at the entanglement during such a sweep, then we can already say that at the beginning, the entanglement must be zero, no? Because this is a classical state. And also at the end, it should be zero, because this is also a classical state. And this kind of makes sense for quantum computation, know that the input and the output is something classical. And in between, we have to make use of entanglement somehow. And in adiabatic quantum computing, this happens by itself. So if we look at entanglement measures, and we can look at different entanglement measures. So in this paper, we looked at, I think, 5 different measures. But what I've plotted here is entanglement entropy. If we look at entanglement entropy as a function of this parameter, then we see that it always goes up. And then at the minimal gap, it's maximum. And now these different colors here, they represent different speeds at which we do this. So the slowest one would be the pink one, and the fastest one would be the blue one. So this means if we do this really adiabatically, it means that the system builds up entanglement and then by itself gets rid of entanglement again. And if we do it too fast, if we do it non adiabatically, then we end up with a finite entanglement in the end. And so there's a very nice direct relation between irreversibility in such a system and entanglement in the system. And in this paper, we actually also give an analytic expression which bounds the success probability or the probability to be in the ground state to the entanglement in the end. So we can actually, if we know the entanglement in our final state, we can actually bound the success probability in the end. So I think that's a nice combination between irreversibility and entanglement here. Now, why are these systems interesting for applications? There is an interesting connection between these infinite range spin glasses and optimization problems. So in particular, one can show that every optimization problem, so in this paper, there's a list of optimization problems listed, that all these problems can be written as a spin glass. And the idea is that one actually rewrites the cost function of these optimization problems as an energy. So this means minimizing the energy of a spin glass is equivalent to finding the optimal solution of these optimization problems. And this has not just applications for this rather abstract MP-Hall problems like traveling salesman, knapsack, minimum spanning tree, and so on, but also for example, for quantum chemistry or protein folding or even machine learning. So machine learning is also an optimization problem written in some parameters. Now, why don't we already have this? Well, there are actually huge challenges. One challenge that I already mentioned is this minimal gap. So if we want to do this adiabatic protocol in some scalable way, then the minimal gap closes exponentially. And the question how it closes exactly is the question how efficient can we do this? So one thing is sure that it closes exponentially, but the question is what is in the exponent? And if it closes exponentially with the square root of the number of qubits, for example, we would expect a quadratic speedup. So we will definitely not get an exponential speedup for any of these problems, but maximally a polynomial one. And the big theoretical open question here is which polynomial speedup can we expect for which problems? Then another problem is connectivity. So all the problems that I've described previously, like the traveling salesman, the protein folding, and so on and so on, they require actually a fully connected spin glass. And this means a spin glass where I can really program every individual connection. So if this would be my qubits, then I would really have to draw a line between all of them. And in particular, I would have to be able to really control every interaction between every qubit. So I really need n squared experimental knobs with which I can program this. Then finite temperature, as I already mentioned, so I really have to do this coherently. And then I probably also want to include n-body terms. No? So in these graph problems, like the ones that I've shown before, I only have pair interactions. But probably I also want to have three-body and four-body interactions. These are interactions that would be important if I want to solve like the three-set problem or four-set problems and things like this. And if I want to have n-body terms, I really need to implement n-body terms on my quantum computer. So if I have only pair interactions available, I can only have pair interactions in my spin system. So maybe I want to also have higher order terms. And then fault tolerance. So in digital quantum computing, at some point we can do error correction. However, in this adiabatic protocols, error correction is much more difficult because when I go through this minimal gap, I have no way how I can do with measurements some error correction. So these are I think the main challenges that one faces, which first have to be theoretically understood before we can actually think about applications for quantum annealing or adiabatic quantum computing. Now, what I would like to present here is, so to say, a different approach which goes completely away from the spin glass. And so to say, in the spirit of the title of the conference, so designer quantum matter, this will be a design how we can actually make spin glasses in a lattice gauge model. So this is the main result. And in the following, I would like to discuss this result and also how we get there. Let me first look at the Hamiltonian that we get out. So in the spin glass paradigm, the Hamiltonian that we look at has these two terms, the trivial one and the spin glass term, which if we draw it, would mean we have our qubits and they are connected via this JIJ matrix and they have to be able to control all the interactions. On the right side, we have a Hamiltonian which consists now of three terms. The first thing that we notice is that the indices here don't go to n but to k, and k is the number of connections in our system. So this means if we have a system like this one, which has n squared connections, then here we need n squared qubits. So the number of qubits is the number of connections in our problem. Then the next thing that you notice is that there are now three terms. So the first term is similar to here, a trivial one, which will be our initial state. Now the second term consists of a local field term with sigma c. And I label this here a j because this is the programmable part. So in this on this side here, the JIJ matrix becomes a local field, and all I have to do is I have to program local fields. So instead of programming interactions, I have to program local fields, which is experimentally, of course, much easier. And then there's a third term which contains all the interactions. So this is a C for constraints. And I will discuss in the following what these constraints are, but what I want to say here is that they are fully local, which means all the interactions are local and with nearest neighbors, which means I don't have any long-range interactions anymore in the system. And these interactions are problem independent. So this means the only thing that I have to fine-tune are local fields, and the interactions are all the same. So to summarize, if I want to encode all-to-all interaction matrix, I can do this by programming only local fields. The architecture has problem-independent interactions, and this actually allows one to implement a quantum annealing or adiabatic quantum computing in a large number of qubit platforms. There is some classical error tolerance in the system, and we can actually implement k-body interactions. So how do we get from the spin glass to this lattice gauge formulation? The first step is that we represent the system by something like dual variables or by variables that live on the links. So if you think about our original spin model, then we want to represent it by new variables which actually represent the relative alignment of two qubits. So for example, if they are pointing in the same direction, then the new qubits would be spin up. If they are pointing in different direction, the new qubits would be spin down. Now, I made them in different colors just to distinguish them, but they are really just physical qubits that we built. Now, this means if we look at a term like this, no, like the interaction term that we had before, the JIJ sigma c, then in these new variables, this becomes like a local field acting on these new variables. Because if this is like an anti-alignment, this would be like a local field pointing down. If this is alignment, it's a local field pointing up. However, if we count now the number of degrees of freedom, then this doesn't fit, because on this side we have only n degrees of freedom. So even though we have k elements in this sum, we only have n degrees of freedom because there's only n spins. And here we have, if we have all-to-all connectivity, we have n squared degrees of freedom. So this means we have to introduce k minus n constraints. So this means this is the number of connections minus the number of spins that we have in the system. Now, what are these constraints? These constraints can be constructed from conditions on closed loops in the original model. Imagine we have three spins and we take a closed loop, 1, 2, 2, 3, and 1, 3. Then if we make a translation table between the old and the new variables, then if all are pointing up, then also the new variables would be all pointing up. If all of the spins are pointing down, again, all variables would be pointing up. Now let's make one example. For if we have, for example, down, down, up, then this would be same parity, so spin up. This would be same parity, different parity, so spin down. This would be different, so spin down, and so on. Now we can try to translate it back. No? For example, we can try up, up, down in the new variables and translate this back to the old variables. And what this would mean is that 1 and 2 have to be in the same direction, 1 and 3 same direction, but 2 and 3 in different direction. That's not possible. So this means in a closed loop on this side, the number of spin down must be even or 0. So we cannot have an odd number of spin downs on this side. And this is true for every closed loop. So we can take any closed loop in the system, and this rule is always true. And this is something that we can now easily translate into an energetical constraint. No? We can just multiply these three variables and put a minus in front. Then this gives us, so to say, an energy penalty if we have an odd number of spin downs. And this means if we choose a closed loop of 3, then we get a 3-body term. If we choose a closed loop of 4, we get a 4-body term, and so on and so on. And now the only challenge in this is now to actually select those closed loops which allow us to make this fully local. So we have here an enormous number of closed loops which we can choose from, but we only need k minus n out of them. So which one should we choose such that we can make a purely local pattern? And it turns out that there is only one solution, and I would like to guide you through this solution. The solution is a closed loop that looks like this. So I go 1 to the right, 2 back, 3 to the right, 2 back. And now if I arrange my qubits in such a way that, with a larger y, I have, so that the difference between these two numbers is, so to say, the y coordinate. So I put the 2, 3 here, 1, 3, 2, 4 here, and 1, 4 here. So this means I have now one constraint. So this gives me one 4-body term. Now I take the same pattern and move it 1 to the right. Then I see that the 2, 4 is already there, so I just have to put 3, 4, 3, 5, 2, 5 here, and so on. So I go once through the system, and now I have 3 constraints. Now if I have 6 qubits, then I need in total 10 constraints. Now the next building block looks like this. I sort of say stretch this pattern by 1. So now I go 2 to the left, 3 back, 4 to the right, 3 back. And then if I look at the elements, I have here 1, 4, 2, 5, 2, 4, and 1, 5, then I see that 3 of them are already there in this upper corner. So this means I just have to put the 1, 5 here, and I have another constraint. And again, go through the system, stretch this again, and with this I build actually a full triangle. Now I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 constraints. I need 4 more. And I've also left out 2 elements, 1, 2, and 5, 6 here. And then if I look at the bottom row here, I see that there are closed loops of 3. No? I have here the 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 4, and so on. So this gives me this 4 additional closed loops which I need. And now they are closed loops of 3. So which means I have now a system which has a lot of 4-body interactions here and a few 3-body interactions here. I can also make this only 4-body interactions if I put here ancilla spins which are always pointing up. So then I have like a system which only consists of 4-body terms. So this means what I get out now in the end is a model where I translated an infinite range spin glass into a lattice gauge model where the randomness is in the local fields and all the interactions are the same and local. So it's completely a local system. And I think this is also from a condensed matter point of view quite interesting, because if you think about a transverse easing model with infinite range interactions, this will have completely different properties than a model which has the randomness now in the local field suddenly and isotropic interactions. Now, the annealing path or the quantum path, if I turn on an additional transverse field, looks completely different, no? Because these sigma x parts here, which are correspond now to the new sigma c's, they have a completely different meaning, no? So in the original model, it's like a superposition of spin up and spin down. Well, here it's now a superposition of like same direction and different direction. So it's a completely different path. The only thing that's basically the same is that the final state is the same. So this is the original model. This would be the infinite range spin glass, and this would be the lattice gauge model. So they have a completely different quantum path, but the final state is the same, and that's where we encode our problem. Now, until now, I've only talked about this pair interaction, but we can also add in the original model the single particle term, simply by adding a row here on the side, because I can say, well, a magnetic field in the original model is like I have an ancilla spin which interacts with all of them, and this is like adding a row here on the side. Remarkably, I can also go in the other direction. So I can say, well, what about three-body terms, four-body terms, five-body terms, and so on. And I can make fully connected three-body terms by doing exactly the same trick. So now I say, well, instead of translating two spins into one spin, I translate three spins into one spin. If they're all pointing up, it's one. If one is pointing down, it's down, and so on and so on. And then the pattern that actually comes out is something three-dimensional. And the trick or the way this is built up here is that the four-body terms act now on the faces of these cubes. And the trick is that on each side, there is always one index which is the same. No? For example, if you look at this side here, the six index six is always there. Or if you look at this side, the index two is always there. So this means if I multiply this out, this gives me a sigma c to the fourth, which I can take out, and I have, again, exactly my same plaquettes as I had before. So this means in this mapping, the k locality of the interaction becomes the dimensionality of my grid. And it's quite intuitive to look at this from this way, because if I look at the back side of this, for example, then I have my original triangle, no? So this means the back side of this construction is the two-body terms, and this line here is the single particle terms. So this means I really start here from 1D, which is single particle terms, then I get this 2D pattern, which is the pair interactions, and the 3D part, which gives me the three-body terms. Now, if I want to have four-body terms, I have to build something four-dimensional, but so to say, for all-to-all three-body, this would be the maximum that I can do in three dimensions. Now, another interesting aspect about this is that there is some classical error correction in it, and this was work done by Fernando Pastavsky and John Preskill. They actually realized that in this mapping, we have the possibility to do exponential error correction for classical bit flip errors. And the idea is to say, well, if for this construction you have chosen now a certain set of closed loops, but all the other closed loops, they still have to fulfill the condition that the number of spin down must be an odd number. So this means if I take a closed loop, for example, 1, 2, 2, 4, 1, 4, then I know that the number of spin down must be even. And now I can say if I want to know the value of 1, 2, I can read out all closed loops that contain 1, 2 except for 1, 2. So if I know, for example, 2, 4 and 1, 4, and then the number of spin down is odd, it means that this must be spin down. And here I have an exponential number of these closed loops which I can read out. And this actually gives me exponential error correction for classical bit flip errors. So this doesn't help for the annealing in the minimal gap, but it helps for bit flip errors due to the coherence. Now, one of the most intriguing directions, I think, of this mapping is that it opens adiabatic quantum computing, quantum annealing, to new platforms. For the infinite range spin glass, I need some long range interactions which I can tune, and currently flux qubits are the only ones that actually have some quasi long range at least. Now, with this mapping, I have now only nearest neighbor interactions, and this is something that I have in on a square lattice, which I have in many platforms. And I just want to point out, or I want to talk about Rydberg atoms, and also just mention superconducting qubits now in the following. The main problem, or the main challenge, you might say, is, well, how do you do these four-body terms? That's basically something that seems very counterintuitive, that this can be implemented efficiently. But actually, it turns out that here, we don't really need a full four-body interactions. The reason is the following. Imagine you have really a four-body term. This means the Hamiltonian has two levels which are both eightfold degenerate. And the ground state would be one where we have one state all up, six states, two up, two down, one state all down. And the bad ones would be three up, one down, or four up, three down, one up. Now, in this case, we actually don't need to really build the four-body term. We actually need the four-body constraint, which means we are only interested in the ground state. Because in this mapping, the ones that do not fulfill the rule that the number of spin down is even, they do not matter. They are unphysical states. This means we only have to create a Hamiltonian that actually has a ground state, which is degenerate, which contains these parts. Now, this can be easily done by the so-called stabilizer formalism. So if we just sum up our four spins, then there's only three possibilities, no, minus 4, 0, or plus 4. This means if we add a Q-trit in the middle,